obviously we're being joined by Jesse Miller. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
I will address this.
My name's Greg Miller, and I am the Minister of Justice Friday. Mr. Hank's journey, this case started in 2003. This case has been before the court on two occasions. One wherein this court reversed the denial of an evidentiary hearing in this particular matter. And I think carefully in statements to hopefully, I'd like to quote what this court said in statements to hopefully. Given the critical role of this DNA evidence surviving corroborating Hank's confession, Hopeful's reported concern about testing of cause were not credible. What the court was addressing there, Mrs. Kofler in his case had said, why do you have all this other evidence that proved that the DNA of Greg Gonzalez was in the dumpster tested because it would have cost too much? This court found that defense not credible in that case, saying, again, that the DNA evidence found in the dumpster was the critical piece of evidence corroborating any statements that Ivan Hank would have made. This is post-conviction proceedings. Most of it was initially started by prior counsel who took the tact of the conduct in this case was so outrageous that it requires reversal of Mr. Hank's conviction, not just a remand for a new trial. The evidence is basically that Mr. Kofler, choosing to act by himself, but under the color of law, planted evidence in a dumpster that ended up being critical to the defense of this case. When that evidence was taken into account with any other factors, particularly statements that he made, it made the case perhaps untriable. I still remember the day that it was reported in the World Herald that DNA evidence was found in 2003. And I walked into my partner's office and I said, this can't happen. I mean, I was just reading the account in the World Herald. Counsel in this case, defense counsel, was able to look at this and decide whether he should attack that. And Mr. Susi's deposition in that regard is pretty poignant at times. He indicated that he, at the time, was the DNA expert in the public advocacy office. This is Hamburg Public Advocacy. He indicated that, in his own mind, he questioned the DNA evidence immediately, too.
Did he have a strategy?
Well, and that's where I think his testimony may vary at various times. He says his strategy was that he was going to attack it at the time of trial without any expert of his own. Okay, he didn't have the evidence tested at all. He went ahead and decided that. Or he says he decided that he was going to wait until trial, lie in wait, and then all of a sudden attack it as this is incredulous and there must be a mistake. He truthfully thought it was a mistake, not planted evidence. And that was clear throughout his testimony and his deposition. He wasn't questioning Mr. Kofler at that time at all.
So does that strategy make him incompetent?
what would it have gained the defendants had defense counsel had the material tested? Do they really want to know?
No, I guess I'm not talking so much about whether he should have tested the material or not, although that's a collateral issue. I think it's more important whether he sought anybody to attack the possibility that this evidence that had sat in a dumpster for 6 months through the whale mines could possibly survive, and whether any DNA evidence could possibly survive. In that regard, I asked Mr. Susie during his deposition quite regularly, Mr. Susie, did you seek any evidence or any experts on damnation? No, I didn't. Then I asked him, did you consult any experts? And he says, no. I was going to ask their experts at the UNMC, but then I thought I'd give my tact away. I said, well, did you depose anyone in this case? He says, no, I didn't want to know my strategy.
Does that make him incompetent?
I mean, Mr. Simpson was a very good attorney. Did he make a severe mistake and then cost Ivan Haynes in this case? I believe so. I believe that by failing to attack that DNA, there's kind of a domino theory on it, is that if he attacks that DNA and it turns up dirty, and all of a sudden in the newspaper, Mr. Kofo is being attacked for his dirty evidence in this case, that then changes the whole course of this case, and the cooperation of the DNA evidence, which is part of the confessions that this court found so important in the Kofo case.
Mr. Kofo, was there any evidence in the record in regard to Mr. Sosie's expertise in DNA versus other criminal lawyers there?
I don't think he had particularly any training. He did have a science background, I believe. And I think that he had, he at least held himself out of the deposition as being particularly skilled, at least of lawyers at that time, in DNA evidence.
Could you say something like in his testimony? Presenting DNA things to the veteran of the advocacy group that he's the guy to go to.
He did say that. He stated he was the expert in the public advocacy's office.
Before your time expires, would you address the propriety of amending the motion for post-conviction relief after the remand by this court?
Well, the state is pulling straight for your cane in that regard, which was what I was just here on not long ago, and that there could be no change. I guess I would point to remand in this case, wherein this court said, we're going to remand for the court to hold an evidentiary hearing on whether his constitutional rights were violated.
Haven't we always said in these types of cases you have to read the opinion as a whole to determine the scope of the remand? You can't cherry pick the ones you like.
That's correct.
And how does that affect the argument?
Well, and two things in that regard. First of all, Mr. Simpson was trial counsel at the time. So at the time of filing the post-convicted is there on behalf of Mr. Haynes. He can't post-convict himself. New situation popping up, I understand how that may confuse matters. But the second question would have been, this court did not remand that Mr. Haynes' case
until after the one-year statute of limitations in filing a post-conviction that arguably run at that time. That started. He was subject to the 2011 change in statute, and this court did not remand it until November of 2012. I'm not sure he had any remedy at that point. Does that justify what the court did? I'm hoping it did. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Duffy, good morning to you.
Good morning. May I please the court, counsel? I'm Siobhan Duffy, Assistant Attorney General, occurring on behalf of the Appellee and Cross Appellant, the State of Nebraska. A brief procedural history. Appellant filed his motion for post-conviction relief in 2009, alleging two claims. The district court denied the motion without an evidentiary hearing, and on appeal, this court determined that the appellant had in fact alleged claims, which warranted an evidentiary hearing, and remanded the matter back to the district court to hold such a hearing. Back at the district court, appellant moved for leave to amend his motion for post-conviction relief to assert an additional claim, ineffective assistance of trial counsel, and the district court permitted the amendment. The state believes this was an error, as it was outside the scope of this court's mandate, and therefore the district court did not have the authority to allow the appellant to assert additional claims on remand. We filed a cross-appeal regarding this issue. I'll just note, as was brought up, that recently in State v. Kane, this court stated that a trial court is without power to affect rights and duties beyond the scope of the remand from an appellate court, and any order attempting to do so is entered without jurisdiction and is void.
So what was the scope of the remand?
Sure. I believe it would be two claims alleged in the petition that this court reviews on appeal. I do think that when reading the opinion of the appeal, they noted the two claims that were brought forward, and neither of them addressed the effectiveness of trial counsel that was received. To the extent this court disagrees, I did address those, the merits of those claims in my brief, and would submit on the merits of those claims on brief, unless this court has specific questions it would like me to address at this time. The state believes the only two claims that are properly before the district court and thus this court were the claims that Hunt raised in his original motion, and the state believes the district court correctly denied these claims. The district court concluded that Hunt was required to show that any constitutional error that occurred would have led him to reject the plea agreement and proceed to trial. The district court assumed without deciding that a constitutional violation occurred, and the state will do likewise for purposes of our analysis. Appellant's first claim is that his constitutional rights were violated by law enforcement allegedly planting evidence in a dumpster. While Appellant argues that had this been revealed to him at the time, he would have rejected his plea agreement, he failed to meet his burden to prove this. Appellant had other reasons for taking the plea agreement. He discussed in his deposition that he had an interest in keeping statements he had made from being made public, and he brought this up at the plea hearing itself. In a discussion with the district court, Appellant specifically addressed that the plea would result in his statements not being made public. Additionally, the evidence against Appellant, not including the DNA found in the dumpster, was overwhelming. Even if Appellant could show a constitutional violation occurred, he has not shown prejudice, and the district court correctly denied that claim.
You say it's overwhelming. What evidence are you referring to?
The district court noted in its order that Appellant had been the last person seen with the victim. When Appellant was approached by police on an unrelated matter the day of the victim's disappearance, he fled, led police on a high-speed chase. It was later found that the victim's, his DNA, I believe from blood, was in the trunk of the car Appellant was driving. While Appellant was at the hospital, the officer who was with him for security reasons questioned him because the officer had been contacted by the victim's mother about the whereabouts of the victim, and Appellant first said, oh, he's at home. When told, no, he's not at home, he said, well, oh, he's with friends in Omaha. When told, no, he's not there, Appellant said, oh, well, then I don't know where he is. The victim's DNA, I believe in blood splatters, was found on Appellant's pant and left shoe. He stated in open court at his sentencing a few months after the disappearance, when he was being sentenced for the fight from police, stated in open court that he killed the victim. He then gave three interviews with investigators where he made incriminating statements. At his plea hearing, when he pled guilty to a charge, he did plead guilty and was questioned by the district court as to whether he had, in fact, killed the victim. Appellant responded affirmatively. So I think that And I think that in the depositions of both the prosecutors who have been involved at the trial level, as well as defense counsel at the trial level, I think most people were in agreement that had this dumpster evidence not come to light, had there not been DNA found in the dumpster, that the state could still have proven their case at trial, that there was not a question that the evidence excluding the dumpster DNA was sufficient to convict the appellant.
How does that relate to whether or not he would have taken the
mix? Yes. And Your Honor, I think it is, as I mentioned in my brief, it's at least in the context of ineffective assistance of trial counsel, and I think the reasoning applies here, that it does need to be self-serving declarations that the defendant would have gone to trial will not be enough. He must present objective evidence showing a reasonable probability that he would have insisted on going to trial. And I think when this court reviews the record and looks at the statements that appellant admitted, that he was very concerned about his statements being made public. Not only did he reference that now in his deposition, but he referenced it at the plea hearing. And when looking at it with all the other evidence, I think taken together, he's failed to show objective evidence that there was a reasonable probability that he would have insisted upon going to trial.
Statement about his statements not become publicly, they're already publicly.
Your Honor, I believe that some of them were. I'm not sure exactly on these statements that he made to investigators what was public knowledge about that, but obviously the statements that he made in open court were public. I mean, it was in a packed courtroom. I believe that was some of the testimony. The courtroom was full of people. Yes, you're correct. That statement was public, but regarding what was stated to investigators in those interviews.
Two brief questions for you that are not closely related. The first question is, there are three assignments of error in front of us today. The second assignment of error, the prosecution knowingly or recklessly disregarded falsified evidence. Wasn't that allegation raised in the first appeal and abandoned during the first appeal?
Your Honor, I'm not sure.
The second question, during counsel's argument, Mr. Pippelbar's argument, he expressed the concern with the statute of limitations running. Is there anything that would prohibit a defendant who has a post-conviction motion under adjudication on one ground from filing a separate post-conviction motion on a different ground?
Your Honor, and I will confess, I'm not positive on that. Because the issue of whether a future claim may be barred is not directly before this court, I did not spend a lot of time delving into possible ways in which a claim brought now could or could not be barred. Obviously, a petition could be filed, whether or not the claims raised would be time-barred or in some mechanism. I think that's speculative. It depends on what was raised, how it was raised, when it was raised. I'm not really comfortable stating at this time whether that would be hard.
Thank you.
Moving to a false heading claim, I think the same analysis really applies. First, I don't think the public support evidence that the prosecutors knew or should have known that something was funny about this DNA evidence. I recognize that defense counsel noted in his deposition that he thought DNA degradation was very common knowledge at the time, but he also stated he wasn't able to find experts or studies to back up some of those opinions as to how DNA degrades and the rate at which it does. So I don't know that it was really such common knowledge that everyone just knew or should have known. I think the prosecutors in this case in their depositions, as well as defense counsel, stated that at the time there was no indication that the CSI unit involved was anything other than a well-educated, top-of-the-line crime scene investigation organization. Even if this court were to disagree, I think the same analysis that I went through with Appellant's first claim applies to his second claim, that he had other reasons for taking the plea agreement that had nothing to do with this evidence, and that when viewed objectively, based on his desire to keep the statements from being made public, as well as the other evidence against him, He has not shown a reasonable probability that he would have insisted upon going to trial.
Is that an answer to Justice Castle's question about amending or filing a separate post-conviction if certain facts come to light at a later time?
I will just say I haven't gone through everything that would affect whether that could be done or not. So I'm not really comfortable giving you a firm answer on that. I have reached the end of my prepared remarks. If there are no additional questions from this court, I request you affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. Mr. Pivovar, you will play into this matter.
I will.
Thank you very much for your service.